Coming up on Tech News Today, Google's subscription music service, Homeland Security, blocks Bitcoin, and Netflix eats the web. Did they leave any for YouTube? All that and more coming up.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for early on a Wednesday morning, May 15th, 2013. Tech News Today is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over 20 million high-quality stock photos, illustrations, vectors, and video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 30% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code TNT5. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Tom Merritt.
I'm Sarah Lane.
I'm Aya Zaktar.
And filling in for Jason Hell this morning, I'm Alex Gumpel. Now, I know what you're thinking. Jason Howell's having another baby. Well, not really. He's out on assignment this morning. Right, Tom?
Unless that baby is Android 4.3, no. He is not having another baby. yes, Jason is down at Google I.O. Thank you, Alex, for filling in. Good to see you again. We've also got Aaron Newcomb joining us a little later on the show to discuss the stories of the day. But let's start with the top 10 stories of the day in the news. Google has signed licensing deals with Universal and Sony to provide a subscription music service, according to The Verge. Sources say Google plans to create a separate service from the Google Play Store and YouTube. So you'll get one subscription service for each. Earlier this year, Warner reportedly signed a deal with Google, meaning the subscription service will have all three major music companies.
Google CEO Larry Page has disclosed via a blog post that he has vocal cord paralysis in his left vocal cord, which is a health condition that can result in hoarse speech and labored breathing. The co-founder can't exercise at peak capacity and also says he'll have to limit his participation in some company events like quarterly conference calls. He also said his condition has improved and he's able to do all that's required of him at work and home.
Before Google I.O. kicked off this morning, a new version of Google Maps leaked and was promptly taken down by Google. However, Droid Life grabbed screenshots, which show Google Earth integration, the ability to compare multiple modes of transportation, including flights, along with a brand new layout. The new Google Maps will also build a tailored map for every search you make.
HP announced the SlateBook X2, the first Android detachable tablet with NVIDIA's Tegra 4 processor. X2 has a 10.2-inch HD display with a keyboard dock that has its own battery in there. HP estimates battery life at 14 hours for the tablet and dock together. SlateBook should arrive in August for $479.
Apple has responded to the Justice Department's accusations that it conspired with publishers to push up ebook prices. Apple says it negotiated with publishing companies separately, crafting different agreements with each. The Justice Department accused Apple back in April of last year of colluding with five publishers to push up prices as Apple prepared to launch its iPad. It's since settled with the publishers, but Apple says those publishers decided, independent of Apple, to eliminate discounts on wholesale books of e-prices, selling lucrative hardcover books first to bookstores in a practice called windowing, and to take other measures to push Amazon to raise prices.
Germany has had enough of Google's autocomplete tomfoolery. A German federal court told Google to ensure that its autocomplete does not generate offensive or defamatory suggestions. The case originated by a businessman who found his name linked with fraud and Scientology at Google.de. Google will now have to remove defamatory word combinations when alerted about them.
The Department of Homeland Security has issued a seizure warrant for the funds associated with MT Gox's Dwolla account. Dwolla is the main way people buy and convert bitcoins from MT Gox. Mt. Gox says they have not heard why their account was seized. Dwolla says they can't say why it was seized. And the Department of Homeland Security says they won't say why it was seized, at least not yet.
The European Commission plans to send a formal warning to China that it's ready to levy trade duties against telecoms equipment makers Huawei and ZTE over what it says are illegal subsidies, people close to the matter said. EU Trade Chief Karel de Gucht is set to win support to send the warning letter and show China's new president that the EU is serious about countering what it says is state support.
Rovio wants to share its glow with other game developers, so it's launching Rovio Stars. This is not an all-star game. It's the new effort that will give old Rovio marketing pushes to games made by third-party developers. First game will be Icebreaker, a Viking voyage from Nitrone Limited, followed by Tiny Thief by Five Ants. Developers can apply for the program at Rovio's website.
The Verge reports that Microsoft will be ditching Microsoft points in favor of a new gift card system. The gift cards would work like pretty much any other gift card. True currency are on the cards. Additionally, debit and credit cards would be supported to purchase downloadable content. The new system would work all over the Microsoft world, including Windows Phone Store, Windows Store, and Xbox. The new payment system could be announced at E3 and should launch with the next Xbox later this year.
This episode of Tech News Today brought to you by coffee and also by Shutterstock.com. At Shutterstock, you'll find the perfect image or video. They got videos, too, for your next creative project. I use it all the time for the It's a Thing blog that I do for the show I do with Molly Wood, because we always have these weird images like, you know, whiskey and subscription clothing. And where am I going to find an image that fits that? You know where I find it? I find it at Shutterstock. They have an amazing search engine. You could type in pretty much anything you think of in there, and they're going to find several images that'll work for you. Go to Shutterstock. Check it out. They're adding 10,000 images every day. So every time you visit, you're going to find something new. And it's not just 10,000 random images. They actually work with professional photographers. They review each image individually for content and quality before adding it to the library. So you know you're going to get good stuff. Sophisticated search tools, new spectrum tool, and they have these shareable light boxes. So if you're doing collaborative projects, you can throw a bunch of images in there and everybody can see what's in there and kind of decide what stuff you're going to use. They have offices all over the world too. China, Italy, Brazil, Belgium, Germany. A truly global marketplace. But you should just try it out for yourself. Go to Shutterstock.com. Sign up. The account's free. You don't have to give them a credit card or anything to sign up. Start using that search engine. Start searching around for videos and images. Whatever your next project could be, like some stuff, favorite some images, put them in a light box maybe, share them around with friends. And once you decide that you're ready to purchase, remember this offer code, TNT5, and new accounts will receive 30% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com for 30% off new accounts. Use offer code TNT5, and we thank Shutterstock for their support of Tech News Today. Joining us now at this ungodly early time, which actually really isn't that early for most people in the world, but it's early for us. Aaron Newcomb, thank you so much for joining us today. It's great to have you in.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's actually not too early for me. I'm usually here on Floss at 8:30, so it's only a half hour early. It's not that
bad. Exactly. For the live viewers, we had to preempt Floss because of Google I.O. coverage later in the day, so we thought we'd at least try to give them a little bit of the flavor of Floss Weekly by having you on.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. Let's start off, Sarah, with this music service, the subscription music service that we're hearing about from Google.
Yeah, so sources are telling The Verge that Google has signed separate licensing deals with Universal Music Group and Sony Music for both YouTube and Google Play. And as you mentioned, Tom, those would be apparently separate music subscription services. So something for, you know, Android devices. And then YouTube is its own thing. What's interesting about that is YouTube sees over 800 million unique visitors per month, and music videos are extremely popular. So it makes sense that possibly, if done right, Google could split these up. Now, the New York Times is reporting Google's not going to offer a free tier for its streaming service. The streaming service is supposedly going to look a lot like a streaming service like Spotify, for example. Now, if Google's going to be competitive, subscription music services like Spotify or RDO usually charge around $10 per month for full access and mobile access as well. Wall Street Journal's reporting that as part of negotiations for music subscription, YouTube is possibly looking at some sort of an audio-only license. So this is, I don't think the story that Google's trying to put together a music service. We've heard that there was a deal with Warner Music earlier this year. Obviously, if both Sony and Universal are now on board, it's a much more viable product. And then we've also heard that Apple's got the rumored service, which is supposedly going to be more like Pandora, more of a radio station rather than a la carte subscription. Aaron, what do you make of this? Do you think it makes sense to have a Google Play version of a music streaming service along with a YouTube version?
Not really. I mean, this is tailor-made, or at least everything that I've seen is tailor-made to fit into their existing Google Music platform. Because then you listen to the stuff that you own, and if you don't own it, you pay a subscription service to listen to other stuff. From an infrastructure standpoint, it makes more sense to put it there. But like you were saying, from a popularity standpoint, I mean, if you're on Reddit and you go to Our Music, just about every link there goes to YouTube. It doesn't go to Spotify. It doesn't go to RDO. It doesn't go to – sometimes it goes to what's the other music service? SoundCloud for some things. But almost inevitably, it always goes to YouTube. So from where the eyeballs are already at, from that standpoint, it would make sense to do something in YouTube.
Ayaz, does this seem, I mean, you know, this is something that we might know a lot about in just an hour or so, because of course Google I.O. our live coverage of that is happening right after we record the show. Does it seem like Google's, you know, are they going to launch a Spotify competitor that has the chance of being bigger and better than Spotify?
I think they got a good chance of that, especially with their sharing ability when it comes to Google Music. Like on Google Plus, you can share things easily and say, hey, listen to the songs I have in my own collection. Unlike Spotify, which doesn't have a web component, at least in the U.S., there's a beta version out there. I know you can try that out. But I think because of Google's web presence, they have a good chance of doing something pretty impressive. And they've done okay with their desktop software as well. So if they wanted to have a desktop client or app for the streaming service, that probably would be pretty good as well. As Aaron was saying, if it integrates well with Google Music, it'll be all right. Although I'm kind of curious about the idea of walling it away from YouTube, because right now Google Play videos and YouTube videos, not necessarily the same thing, but it's got some of the same content. So it seems a little bit confusing, but that's something Google's got to figure out.
Yeah, and it's not just music videos too, right, on YouTube. It's also a lot of times people put the music up and just put like pictures. You know, it's not really even a video, right? It could be the lyrics to the song. It could be something else. And you'll notice that a lot of times that music is licensed and it is used by permission because the people that own the rights to that music are savvy enough to realize it's better to get the music out and let people listen to it. So they allow them to license those songs sometimes. So, yeah, I don't know. It just, like I said, from an infrastructure standpoint, it makes a lot more sense to integrate it with Google Music because I think the infrastructure is there. It's really just going back to the server and doing a check. Do they own the music or do they have a subscription? And then once you know that, then you can stream the music to the client.
Yeah, I just think it'll be weird to see how YouTube does this separately because you can already listen to music there. And this isn't going to give you a blanket license as a producer of videos on YouTube. So I'm curious how that's all going to shake out. Let's talk a little bit about Homeland Security riding in and shutting down Bitcoin payments from Dwolla. Now, this was a little hard to wrap your head around, but Department of Homeland Security and the U.S. District Court for the District of Maryland issued a seizure warrant. So this is with a warrant. That means they showed the court cause that they needed to have the funds associated with Mutum Segilem's Dwolla account. That is Mt. Gox or MT Gox's account at Dwolla ceased and the funds transferred. So Dwolla has transferred the funds, the balance of the funds in that account. That's all of Mt. Gox's funds from Dwolla to the DHS. A DHS spokeswoman declined to comment on the case, saying in order not to compromise this ongoing investigation being conducted by ICE, that's Immigration, Homeland Security Investigations in Baltimore. Mt. Gox says, as of this time, we have not been provided with a copy of the court order and or warrant and do not know its scope and the reasons for its issuance. And that leaves them with other ways to move money in and out. If you want to be, you know, if you're in the U.S. and you want to buy Bitcoins from Mt. Gox, you cannot use PayPal. PayPal forbids currency exchange, but you could use BitInstant or OKPay or Arum Exchange. Those are unaffected at this point. So What's our best guesses here for what's going on? Because it's ICE, it's likely some sort of fraud or money laundering type of situation. But is it something they're going against Mt. Gox for? Is it something that they're going against a user on Mt. Gox? And the only way they can get to them, because it's Bitcoin and untraceable, is to seize the whole account? Or is this some sort of weird currency violation situation, which seems unlikely with ICE? Aaron, if you had to guess, what would you guess?
I've got to believe it's some sort of fraud going on. Somebody's figured out some way to manipulate Bitcoin in their favor, and they've caught on to this, and that's why they're trying to shut it down. Like you say, it's the only way really to do it, since it is a virtual currency. So I've got to imagine something's going on with that. They've uncovered it, and they're trying to stop it before it gets out of control.
I think that you're probably right, but then that seems like a heavy hammer to convince a court to issue a warrant saying, well, we know this person is trading Bitcoins on Mt. Gox, but because of the nature of Bitcoins and because they're in Japan, we can't find out who it is. So let's seize one of their payment systems that we know this person has been using and basically shut down the ability for the entire company to use Dwolla to move money in and out. And you seize all of a company's funds? Does this make any sense to you, IS?
Well, this is the Department of Homeland Security and ICE. So they've seemed to be pretty heavy-handed in general when it comes to shutting down anything. They seem a little bit overreaching at times. So it seems like it's in line with them. It seems a little crazy, but it also seems in line with the two departments. Like Aaron was saying, this seems like a fraud kind of concept because we've seen Bitcoin, like the fluctuations in its valuation has changed so much over the past couple of weeks. There's something going on there. So it's not just the standard, okay, well, there's market conditions are changing. It seems like there might be some wrongdoing going on. And these two departments going in, being this heavy-handed, it seems in line with them to me.
Yeah, I mean, the government hasn't really shown themselves to be too bright in the matter of what happens on the internet and how it works. I mean, even if you look at the recent case where they, I'm sure you guys covered it, where they yanked the blueprints for the 3D printable gun off that one website. And it's like, this is the internet. The plans are all over the place at this point because they've been released on the internet. And now you've just drawn attention to the fact that this is out there and people are sharing it all over BitTorrent. So, you know, kind of had the opposite effect of what they were intending. So, you know, I mean, it could be that Dwolla itself is implicated somehow in the fraud, not just the activity that was going on, but maybe Dwolla was in on it somehow. I mean, of course, this is all just speculation. We'll have to wait and see what comes out. But I don't know. Maybe that's what's happening.
Yeah, it is all speculation. You're right. But it would be as if, say, a Swiss bank had their wire transfer company shut down so you could no longer send money to or from the bank from the United States. It's the best metaphor I can think of in the traditional sense. And the fact that they haven't let Mt. Gox know anything yet does lend some credence to your idea, Aaron, that maybe it has something to do internally with Dwolla and the way that they were sending money to or from. But you're right. We'll have to wait until we get more details. Let's move on to how Netflix is eating the entire internet, IOS.
Pretty much. Internet usage tracker Sandvine says Netflix was the number one video downstream source for the first half of 2013 for fixed networks. And what it means by fixed networks, non-mobile internet. So think about the internet that comes to your house. With 32.3% of streaming. Now, YouTube was number two with 17.11%. Hulu has a measly 2.41%. And Amazon has something even more pathetic of 1.31%. Now, if you compare this to last year, the second half of 2012, Netflix is actually down from 33%, a little drop. Hulu is up from 1.1. YouTube is up from 14.8. Amazon is down a little from 1.75. But when you look at mobile, it's completely different. YouTube has the lion's share of 27.33%, which is up from 27.1%. And Netflix is around 4%. Sarah, do you think there's anything competitors can do to unseat Netflix in the home?
That's a good question, especially since not only is Netflix's numbers, you know, or their share of these numbers not dropping, but I think in this study it also showed that Netflix also had the majority of what they call, it's like home roaming, right? And the idea is like, well, maybe you're not sitting at your living room TV just watching Netflix, but maybe you're, you know, in your bedroom watching Netflix on your iPad. So there are just a lot of devices that people enjoy Netflix content on, even when they're using their home Wi-Fi network. I think, you know, really, and I use Netflix, but I also, I definitely am watching Hulu quite a lot. Every once in a while, I use Amazon streaming. I very rarely watch movies and that sort of thing, you know, that's sort of big video stuff from YouTube. But I understand why YouTube would be number one in mobile. It seems like Netflix just kind of has that brand recognition still. I mean, people always say, you know, streaming stuff like Netflix. It's kind of, it's become this brand that everyone really understands what Netflix does. A lot of people have subscriptions, and especially with Netflix's hits like House of Cards, you know, those and his word spreads. I think that viewership just kind of continues to spike.
Aaron, are you surprised that Hulu and Amazon have such a small share of the fixed networks?
I'm more surprised that YouTube has a small share. Now, like you said, in mobile, it's different, but YouTube is structured for mobile. It's a lot easier for people to watch a mobile video from YouTube than it is to watch a Netflix, just because the streaming demands are so much more. And I think what we'll see is that in the next generation of speed on mobile devices, I think you'll see Netflix dominate there as well. Like Sarah was saying, Netflix is extremely ubiquitous. They have done an awesome job at providing clients for all of these devices. So you can get Netflix just about anywhere you go, and it makes it really, really easy for people to subscribe and watch. And so I think they've done a really, really good job there. If you look at like what Amazon has done, for example, not quite as good. Hulu is getting there. They're at least better than at being available, a little bit better than Amazon is. You know, I try to watch Amazon on my computer connected to the TV, which runs Linux. It's just about impossible. Google TV doesn't have, to my knowledge anyway, unless it's just come out on Amazon movie streaming or, you know, streaming video client. So you can't watch there, but Netflix is available on all of those devices, except for with exception for Linux, but that's hopefully coming soon.
Tom, do you think this becomes a starter for Amazon for that set-top box rumor? Like they have to get on this because they don't have the home.
Yeah, maybe. Amazon does. You can get Amazon on Google TV because of the way Amazon works its video. It allows you to stream from the website. And so there's an icon there, but it's not. It's like HBO Go, right? It's not the best interface because it's a desktop interface that you're trying to use on a set-top box. So yeah, Amazon definitely would benefit from their own hardware. I agree with Aaron, though. I think the most interesting thing here is what's happening to YouTube. YouTube, according to Sandvine, is the global leader when it comes to fixed and mobile networking. Probably the reason for that is Netflix isn't available globally. It's only available in certain parts of the U.S. Well, it's in the U.S., Canada, U.K., Latin America. It's only available in certain parts of the world. So this trend seems to say that high-quality long-form video is the wave of the future. And as Netflix rolls out other places in the world, you'll see them start to gain more market share, or maybe other services across the world that are competing with Netflix in different areas will start to gain more traction. And you see YouTube trying to get people to do long form. They launched their subscription channels. They've got live events happening more often. And it's not, at least in the U.S., it really hasn't gained them the traction. Where they're winning is where short form is better, which is on mobile. And I kind of think short form will always be better on mobile. I'm not sure that Netflix can increase that too much. But yeah, there's a lot of room here for Hulu and Amazon if they can get more awareness and more ubiquity to grab share. And I think that's one of Hulu's problems, is the fact that you have to have Hulu Plus, whereas you don't have to have Hulu Plus on the desktop to be able to watch it. Whereas Netflix, it's one thing. You subscribe or you don't get it. That's it. It's an easy choice.
And the other thing is Amazon doesn't work on Android with their instant video anyway. You have to use their Kindle hardware for that. You got to do some really clever work around for your Android device to do it. So they're missing out on mobile there. They don't have a set-top box. They do have their applications on Roku and other devices, but I don't think Amazon does a great job explaining, hey, by the way, we're here too. I think because Netflix is on pretty much everything, like you guys were saying, that's a big deal. And YouTube, available on the web, makes it really easy to get their content. Although, strangely, that's not on Roku for some reason still. But that's the big deal. If you're on every device, people will watch you.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And that's what's going on with Netflix. Absolutely. All right. Let's talk a little bit about this HP SlateBook X2. I have to say, when I saw this morning, I was like, maybe a little bit pricey, but it's not out of hand. And it looks kind of neat.
Yeah, it's an Android tablet from HP. It's called the SlateBook X2. Now, it's based on the Envy X2 line. So HP is expanding the X2 brand. It's a 10.1-inch device. It's running Android 4.2.2. And it comes with a keyboard dock that lets you use SlateBook like a traditional laptop. Now, this small screen, the 10.1, has a 1920 by 1200 display. So that's a crazy amount of pixels for that kind of display. It's the keyboard dock has a second battery, gives you two USB ports, an SD card slot, and an HDMI jack. Onboard storage. Now, there's some conflicting reports out there. The press release says 64 megabytes, which can't possibly be right. A couple of sites say that might mean 64 gigabytes. The Verge says 16 gigabytes, so it's somewhere between 64 megabytes and 64 gigabytes. Somewhere in there, I've emailed HP to find out what's going on.
Not 64 terabytes, we know that.
No, who knows? Inside, though, we do know it's powered by a Tegra 4 processor, making this one of the first tablets with a Tegra 4, and the pricing starts at $480. That includes the dock, and it's going to be available in August. Aaron, with expanding its Android offerings, because HP does have one little slate that's not exactly burning up the charts, this is a good idea or a bad idea for HP to expand their lineup when it comes to Android?
I think it's a great idea for them, especially after what happened with Palm. You know, what other choice do they have, really? I think that what's going to happen is you're going to see more and more of these devices with Android running either in a netbook format or like this format, a detachable tablet, a tablet that has a detachable keyboard or however you want to look at it. Because I think Android is becoming so ubiquitous in the – we keep using that word. We're overusing it now. But in the mobile market, people are really familiar with it. I think we're going to see a lot of these. And I'm really encouraged to see HP kind of taking this step and saying, look, we're going to invest in this and make a device that you know, people can use like at work or at home more easily. I know that my wife, for example, has a Nexus 7, and I got her this little keyboard. It's literally it functions as the back of or a cover to the Nexus 7, but the keys are so close together she can't use it. And I certainly can't use it. Her fingers are smaller than mine. She can't even use it. So I think we're going to see more and more of these devices coming out. I think this is just the first wave. It is a little expensive, but as kind of the being in the first wave of these type of devices, especially ones that have expandability, the ports and everything like that, it's probably not way out of line. I'm not going to buy it at this price point, but it's probably not way out of line for what they're giving you.
Tom, what do you make of this this move by HP? Is the device itself unique enough that people will pick it over something from ASUS? That ASUS has had the Transformer for a very long time, but this is HP behind it.
Yeah, I think, you know, when HP sells into the enterprise and people are looking for an enterprise-level tablet and they want Android, which is what HP's running into, they're like, we got lots of Windows tablets. They're like, great, what do you have in an Android? This is a good item for them to have, and they'll sell a lot of these because they're HP, and they just have an in with a lot of folks. I don't have a good sense whether this will just capture people's imagination or not, but it definitely caught my eye. It definitely had me starting to think about it, but I'm like Aaron. I think that price point, while not unreasonable, is probably just a little bit too high for me to take a flyer on it.
Sarah,
maybe it really is 64 megabytes. Maybe there's this crazy cloud offering that we just haven't heard about yet, and that's going to set HP apart from the pack.
Well, I'm looking at
it's
the price.
64 megabyte cache.
I'm looking at the price point of $480, and it does look expensive for a tablet, but it does come with the dock. When you look at the ASUS Transformer, you're looking at about $500 when you're combining the two things. HP is going to package these together. Sarah, do you think that price point is going to scare people, but even though it comes with a dock?
Well, you know, it's funny. When you said $480, including the dock, I went, oh, that's not out of control. Yeah, it's slightly pricey, but to me, this looks like a really solid tablet. You've got your dock. You've got your, let's just call it 64 gigabytes of storage. You got a nice display. You've got the USB. I mean, it's... This seems like the tablet that kind of has everything. And yeah, sure, HP has competition, but I think it makes perfect sense for HP to have an Android tablet that rivals that competition as closely as possible. I mean, there's nothing to be gained by saying, well, if ASUS has a product that people really like, we can't possibly compete with them. So this is a good move for HP.
And the other thing is I think HP's got some really good connections to the retail market. Obviously, Samsung's really made inroads with that with Best Buy and their mini stores inside of that. But HP can get this thing out there and show people that, oh, yeah, we have a tablet as well. Price point isn't so bad as I'm looking at it. And it's going to have a Tegra 4, so it's going to be very powerful when it comes out in August.
So thanks to Mimetic in the chat room, we have the HP site, and it says 64 gigabytes solid-state drive. So they've at least fixed it on this particular website here. Direct from H. Sorry, Sarah. I kind of like.
There goes
idea
my. You know, I was waiting for the super cloud from HP. I guess I'll be waiting a little longer.
All right, let's talk a little bit about Rovio Stars. This is an interesting development for Rovio, the makers of Angry Birds. Right, they're very popular. They got lots of popular games, and now their way of expanding is to say we'll help promote your game. We're going to look for people who aren't us, who are making cool games, and then we'll put a Rovio push behind it. First one's going to be, as I mentioned in the news, Fuse Icebreaker, a Viking Voyage from Nitrome Limited. That's an iOS game. Followed by Tiny Thief by Five Ants. That'll be iOS and Android. And developers can go to the Rovio website, rovio.com/en/developers/apply, and put their game up there. Now, Rovio says you probably want to have an alpha or playable game if you really want us to consider you. And a demo video is probably the best way to introduce the game to us. So it's not like they're going to take everything that comes along. But, Aaron, what do you think? Is this is a cool thing for developers, right? Can it work for Rovio?
Yeah, I mean, if it can work for Valve, it can work for Rovio, right? I mean, I think when Valve first started, you know, they had some games, Half-Life, yeah, great. And then all of a sudden they came out with this notion, hey, we're going to actually come out with this client and you can buy games on it. And people are like, what? Like, there's no way this can ever succeed. But it has. I don't buy games if they're not on Steam now. So I think that Rovio is looking to do the same thing. And really, they're just expanding out into the marketplace and trying to find new ways to make money that aren't directly just developing games. And I think it's a great move for them, actually. I'm really encouraged by this. I don't know that I, as a developer, would want to do this. But if you're looking at developing a business around a game and you need a distribution model, what better way to go than to go with a recognized name like Rovio?
Yeah, it's kind of like the difference between being an indie musician and getting signed by a big label,
right?
Essentially. It's not unheard of in the gaming world for this. Sarah, does it make a difference to you whether Rovio developed the game itself or they're just like getting their push behind it?
Not really, but the idea that it could dilute the brand is a legitimate concern. I mean, yeah, if Rovio is developing in-house games that delight the imagination of the people who play the games, and then all of a sudden bring in a game that's a little, you know, from left field and it kind of doesn't catch on, well, people aren't always going to say anything Rovio does is awesome. Doesn't mean that everything that they develop in-house is always going to be awesome, but I mean, you could kind of think of it as Zynga, right? I mean, Zynga sometimes takes in brands, and then the brands kind of fizzle out because maybe they just had a shelf life to begin with, and maybe because there's sort of a Zynga thing, which it just kind of changes it in people's minds. So I think Rovio is really smart to be expanding their brand and obviously be able to have games and titles that maybe they don't have the bandwidth to create themselves. But it probably will change the public's perception of the brand, for better or for worse.
Yeah, that's an interesting theory right there. It makes me think maybe Rovio would go after some acquisitions this way, kind of as a way to try people out. What do you think of this whole thing, Ayaz?
I think this is really good for those indies anyway, because Rovio is going to be putting a lot of advertising behind it, cross-promotion. If you go to Rovio's site, you can go to the products page. I'm like, what else do they do? I forgot about Amazing Alex was one of the things they do, named after Alex Scumble over there. And Angry Birds. That's the only thing, right, I think of when I think of Rovio anyway. So if you want to diversify what you think about when it comes to Rovio, this seems like a good way to do that without having to necessarily even dedicate resources. You're just saying, hey, you, we're going to deputize you, and you'll get our promotion behind you. It'll be good for Rovio, and it's good for the developers.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think one of the things that Rovio's done very successfully is in their promotion. I mean, they've got this thing down pat. They've had a lot of experience doing this. All of the Angry Birds games have done well. And basically what they're saying is, you know, you pay us some money, and we'll put our resources that we've developed to work for you. And I think they have a very, very good case there. I mean, just look at when, like, Angry Birds Star Wars came out. I would have never thought that they would have landed the rights to do an Angry Birds Star Wars, and they did. They made it work. So, I mean, that's a huge accomplishment. That was the thing that most surprised me. And then it surprised me even more how good, frankly, that game actually was.
I know.
You know, they weren't just capitalizing on the characters. It actually is very playable and fun. So, so I think that's what it is. It's basically saying, look, we've got this experience. Instead of going out and doing all the stuff on your own, come to us. We'll do all the promotion for you. You pay us a little bit of the money, and then we'll get your games more exposure.
Yeah, I think this is probably a win for everybody. And like Sarah said, Rovio has to be careful that they pick things that Rovio would have done on their own that they think are good enough so they don't dilute the brand. But they seem to be good at doing that. I agree with you about the Star Wars game. It wasn't just the same Angry Birds game with, you know, people in Star Wars outfits. It was a good game. Let's finish up our discussion section today by talking about F-Secure's new report on mobile malware. What are we finding out, Sarah?
Well, that mobile malware is still an issue if you're on Android. F-Secure's new report for the latest quarter shows that Android now accounts for 136 out of 149 known threats, which translates to about 91.3% of all malware activity. This is up from 79% in 2012. So on the rise, not the decline. If you're wondering where the other threats are related to, that's Symbian. F-Secure found zero discovered for BlackBerry, for Microsoft Windows Mobile, or Apple's OS. The research also noted that the threats are pretty much always about conning people out of money. 76.5% designed specifically to get users to pay for something rather than just causing damage or getting information. Aaron, a lot of people who use Android will say, for example, iOS, it's closed. Apple's, it created this walled garden and developers can't do things as freely as they should be the way that they are on Android. But when you look at something like this, you can see how this can end up being an issue for users who don't know any better. What's the solution? Do these numbers scare you?
Well, they do scare me. And they, as a longtime Linux fanboy and someone who espouses Linux as a way to keep things secure, and because Android runs on top of Linux, it makes me it's a little sad for me to see this happening. I think that the thing is, people have to remember Android apps run on top of the platform. It's really similar to if you were to load a bad extension or plugin for Chrome, which happens all the time. People develop these, they advertise them, they load them, and then people are like, oh no. So the same thing happens on Android, and it's popular, it's getting targeted. I think that what has to happen, and maybe who knows, maybe we'll hear a little bit more about this in the keynote coming up shortly, but I think that Google has to step in, and they've already started this, but they need to do even more to make sure that when things get released, at least on the Play Store, they're released without malware. Now, because it's an open ecosystem, it is never going to keep people from developing their own app stores and putting, sideloading their own applications. So there's a little bit of user education that has to happen too. When you try to get around because you don't want to pay $5 for a popular application and you go download it from someplace and sideload it, there's going to be a chance that someone's going to sneak something in there. And unless you're going through the Google Play Store, and sometimes even if you are going through the Google Play Store, as we learned about a month ago, there's a chance that you're going to get some malware. So two things have to happen: education, but most importantly, Google needs to step up their work on the Google Play Store and make sure that these things do not get into the market at all.
Tom, part of this report noted that many of the people running the apps that are questionable are also not running updated versions of Android. Is that part of Google's job as well, to make sure that they get the word out that everyone kind of needs to be on the same page? Or is fragmentation so fragmented, it's just kind of got to let it go?
Fragmentation is so fragmented, it's fragmenting our fragment.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's freaking awful. It makes me lose the ability to talk, apparently. I know that there are reasons why the carriers need to test the operating system, but maybe we could use this as a blunt club to get them to update Android on a timely manner. It's important. And I know that they push security patches for the versions that they support, but this just shows that it's important to be as up-to-date as possible above all. And so let's use this to encourage them to get rid of fragmentation. But Android's always going to deal with this, right? They're choosing to have a more open operating system. And I hesitate to use the word open and Windows in the same sentence in front of Aaron. But that's always a question that Windows has had, which is, if they're going to be open to allowing code to execute on Windows, they're going to have to deal with security. And they had their big come to the temple moment earlier in the 2000s that got them serious about security. And maybe this is the kind of thing that needs to happen to Android as well.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I think Google, like I said, just needs to step up and start working on this. There's no cure for it because it is an open ecosystem. So just like Windows, you can go out and download something from some other site and thinking that it's doing what it's supposed to be doing, and behind the scenes it could be doing something else, sending out SMS spam, which I've been getting a lot of lately. So, but there are, fragmentation is an issue as well, like you said. Unfortunately, again, it goes with the territory of having an open. I just saw a phone the other day that was running, selling, and it wasn't a refurbished phone. I mean, it was a new phone that came out that was running like Android 2.3, and I'm thinking, what? Why would you ever do that? I don't understand. Granted, it was a really cheap phone, so I don't know, but it was just like, people need to upgrade their devices more often, and Google needs to do a better job of preventing the fragmentation that's happened in the past. Granted, things were happening fast and furious over the past few years for Android, so it makes sense that there's that fragmentation, but I think we're going to even see that in the announcement today with Android 4.3 as opposed to Android 5.0, right? They're kind of saying, yeah, we agree, and the developers are obviously, or the manufacturers are obviously putting pressure on Google, saying, please don't give us a whole new a dessert to deal with. Just give us the sprinkles on top so that we can go deploy this out to the devices we already have in the marketplace.
Now you've made me hungry. All right, let's see what's on the calendar, Sarah.
Google I.O. starts in just a few minutes, but it's not just today. Tomorrow, May 16th, is day two of Google I.O. The keynote will already be over. That's where you get all the announcements, but lots of developer stuff. So we will definitely be continuing to cover Google I.O. here on TNT. Also tomorrow, Brian Krasnich takes over as CEO of Intel. Give him a warm welcome, will ya?
Yay, Krasnich.
Hey.
Let's see what's incoming.
I don't know how warm that was.
It was lukewarm, but our email's from Sean. Sean says, hey, TNT crew, regarding your discussion of BlackBerry Messenger becoming cross-platform, consider that BlackBerry Enterprise Server 10 provides management of iOS and Android devices as well as, of course, BlackBerry's. Also consider that BlackBerry Messenger through a BES has always been a highly reliable and secure method for enterprise communications, encrypted BBM. Therefore, the importance of cross-platform BBM is in allowing companies to have a secure messaging and integrated management platform that spans all three operating systems. This is BlackBerry targeting their core market with BBM in a way that takes advantage of the reality of BYOD and turns it to BlackBerry's advantage in cases where a BES is in use. By the way, there are already 10,000 BES10 installs in use. He also sent this from his BlackBerry device. That was in his signature. So he's very
good. Good point, Sean. That's something we as you hit on security when we talked about this yesterday, but we didn't talk about enterprise particularly. I don't think
it was the BYOD aspect that I thought was intriguing, because that is happening, right? We keep talking about this idea that everyone's bringing their own device, and fewer people are choosing to pick a BlackBerry. It's usually like you're stuck with one. So this
and being a BYOD provider could be a huge advantage for BlackBerry in a post-device world for them. I think they're just hedging their bets. I don't think they're going to give up on devices anytime soon, but it's a good thing to do. Thorsten Hines, I think Thorsten Hines knows what he's doing in there. You know, he seems to be very careful, but at the same time, taking the right steps, as far as I can tell.
I just want to say this is a very, very old discussion that's been taking place. I mean, this whole issue of BBM on a BES and BYOD was first brought up on BBS a long time ago when I was first logging on to BBSs. So, sorry, too many acronyms in here for me to follow.
Awesome. Well, you know what? That puts you right over the top. We always love having you on, Aaron, but that may be the best acronym salad I have ever seen. Thanks again for joining us. I know you're sticking around for our Google I.O. coverage, and I really appreciate that as well. Let folks know where they can find you and what you're up to these days.
So go to Google Plus and follow me on Google Plus. Add me to your circles. If you're a Facebook fan or Twitter fan, you can find me there as well. But I hang out on Google Plus, and I have a lot of great conversations with people on Google Plus, which is why I prefer Google Plus over other platforms. You can also, if you're going to Maker Faire this weekend, you can find me there. I'll be talking about Open Sprinklr. So this is Maker Faire Bay Area. Open Sprinklr is an open software and hardware platform which runs your irrigation system, like around your house if you've got an automatic irrigation system. It's all open. You can build the thing completely yourself. It's based on either Arduino or Android, Raspberry Pi. It's a really, really cool platform, so I'll be there. So look for the Open Sprinklr booth at Maker Faire and come say hello.
Excellent.
Also, I've got a new job. I just started work at NetApp, so I'm no longer with Oracle. For those that follow me here, you know that it's kind of hard to talk about the whole Java stuff, and really I haven't been able to talk about that stuff. Now I can. Yeah, so I just started at NetApp this week, and they were gracious enough to let me come on over today and join you guys for the show and the Google I.O. coverage. So thank you, NetApp.
Well, yeah, thank you, NetApp, for lending us Aaron. We definitely appreciate that. Don't forget about our subreddit, folks, technewstoday.reddit.com, the place to go to suggest stories, to vote on the suggestions of others. Let us know what kind of stuff you'd like us to talk about each and every day. We definitely take that into consideration when we make our lineups. You can find us on the web, twit.tv/TNT. You can email us, TNT@twit.tv, and give us a call. Leave us a voicemail, 260-TNT-SHOW. We will be back tomorrow with Sasha Segan. We're going to talk about all the Nokia, BlackBerry, Google mobile stuff with him. We'll see you then.